I invite you, if you would, stand with me and let's read from God's word, 1 Peter chapter 4, beginning at verse 1. I invite you to hear the word of the Lord. Since therefore Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same intention, for whoever has suffered in the flesh has finished with sin, so as to live for the rest of your earthly life, no longer by human desires, but by the will of God. You have already spent enough time doing what the Gentiles like to do, living in lasciviousness, passions, drunkenness, revels, carousing, and lawless idolatry. They are surprised that you no longer join them in the same excesses of dissipation, and so they blaspheme. But they will have to give an accounting for him, to him who stands ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is the reason the gospel was proclaimed even to the dead, so that though they had been judged in the flesh as everyone is judged, they might live in the spirit as God does. The end of all things is near. Therefore, be serious and discipline yourselves for the sake of your prayers. Above all, maintain constant love for one another, for love covers a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without complaining. Like good stewards of the manifold grace of God, serve one another with whatever gift each of you has received. Whoever speaks must do as one speaking the very words of God. Whoever serves must do so with the strength that God supplies, so that God may be glorified in all things through Jesus Christ. To him belong the glory and the power forever and ever. Amen. The word of the Lord. You may be seated. So we've been going through 1 Peter, and one of the things that keeps jumping out in the background of this book is that we are called to be resident aliens living in exile. What does that mean? Well, in some regards, what we've learned is that it means we don't quite fit in this world. We don't quite think like they do, act like they do, pursue the same kinds of interests that those outside of God's kingdom do. That's the challenge 1 Peter is also giving to this particular church. How do we live as exiles in this culture, in this present world, in a world that doesn't understand nor give credibility to the idea of a community whose leader is a suffering God that laid down his power and suffer to claim his creation back again? Well, there's an easy kind of answer to this, I think, that comes up when we think about this term, resident aliens. I know the first time I thought of it, heard it, was this concept that was going through my mind, is that I'm stuck here for now, but I don't really belong here. I'm waiting to go home. I like the phrase that says, this world is not my home. But the reality is, God hasn't given up on this planet. God hasn't stopped caring about this planet. He is still in the business of rescuing his creation. In fact, our hope, as articulated by John the Revelator in Revelation 21, looks completely different from the idea of an escapism that says we're out of here. In fact, it says that we're not waiting to go somewhere. We are waiting for heaven to merge with earth and for Jesus to become king of all kings and reign in a new heaven and a new earth. And that we're called to be part of that. God has not given up on this project that he started called creation. And he intends that his people don't either. But how do we live in between today and that day whenever he comes again, in a world that at its best merely harasses us for our devoted way of following Jesus. In this section that we read before us, Peter calls us to arm ourselves with the same enoia as Christ. Now, that's a Greek word. And that Greek word can be interpreted as thought or intention. The understanding here is this, is that Jesus has suffered. And we're supposed to look at that suffering not just as an emotional, I feel bad for Jesus, I guess I'll follow him because that was a really horrible thing that they did to him. It's not that word does not mean emotion, but it does have with it the idea of passion. It looks that the word means to literally have a drive or a motivation within us. It's what makes us want to do the things we do. And Peter tells this church, and as it's been handed down to us, says to us, is that our passion should be like the passion that we see in the eyes of a suffering, crucified Jesus. And it's interesting that he uses a term, uses a word that we interpret arm, which literally is a term of battle. He says, you could translate, weaponize yourselves with the thought of the suffering of Christ when you face this world. That almost seems like it doesn't fit to me. I don't know about you, but if I'm going to arm myself, I'm going to get something with a lot of power, usually with a big scope, right? I'm going to make sure that I can take down whatever the enemy is. But Peter calls us to be a people who are armed with a thought that says, boy, I'm going to handle this situation is I'm going to think like Jesus did when he laid down his life on the cross. When people attack me and mistreat me and misuse me, I'm going to have a thought like Jesus would have had when he was being nailed to the cross, when they crushed the thorns across his brow. I'm thinking to myself when I'm studying this week is, that doesn't fit for me. I don't think of arming myself as someone who's going to be suffering. I arm myself so I don't have to suffer. It reminded me of the phrase that we've heard a couple of times in recent days, studying 1 Peter. It's once again a call to the church. You don't fight fire with fire. You fight fire with love. With a love that's willing to even suffer. And he goes on. And Peter says that in this picture, this armament that we have, that what we're really looking at is not just a change in our behavior, but we're looking in a change in what drives us. We've often hear our pastor, whenever he's calling us to worship, we'll use this phrase. We worship a God who would rather die than live without us. I was challenged again by those words as I looked at this passage. If I'm arming myself with the same intentions and the same passions of Jesus, then there's somewhere inside of me that phrase needs to connect for me too, to where I would rather die than not do good for this world. I would rather die than not help a brother or sister in need. I would rather die than see people hurt and be in pain because of the sin of this world. And right then and there, when that thought struck me, I thought, am I even qualified to be part of this community? Am I really qualified to call myself a follower in the way of Jesus, who says, don't fight fire with fire, Don't try to use brute force to overcome the enemy. Lay down and suffer for your enemy. Wow. I'm stuck right there. And I'm struggling. Because the thing is that I don't want to be like that in the way that I've been kind of influenced by my world. This culture that I'm part of says that's not how you get ahead. That's not how you get to where you want to be. That's not how you're successful. The truth is that this world says that those kind of intentions are not going to get you anywhere except unsuccessful poverty for your life. And so I guess where I struggle at is I want to reminisce. Did you hear the words of Peter whenever he was talking to this church? Wow, it seems really quiet in here. I feel like something's going on. I need to come up with a good joke or something to loosen you people up. Come on. So maybe it's just too heavy for us, right? Maybe Peter's doing something for us that's a little tough. He's making us really look into the face of a crucified Jesus. That's a pretty tough scene. And he wants it to not only be what we do, but he wants it to be our passion. You see, if we just are all about our doing, well, we can behave for a while, but eventually we stop behaving. I know, ask my parents, they're here today. Ask my wife for that matter. But when my passion, when what drives me is to do those things, I'll do them anyway. If my passion, I mean, parents know it. You guys know it as parents. I mean, it's one thing for your kids to clean the room, right? If they're grumbling and complaining and about this, I gotta clean my room. They might be successful at cleaning the room, but it's not what we're really looking for, is it? We want them to be passionate about being clean. We hope. We hope that when they take a shower, they scrub vigorously, you know, so that when they're out there, they smell good, you know? Not just, I'm getting wet, it's cool, I'm done. I took a shower. We don't smell like you took a shower. So. You see, behavior is one thing. Passion is what makes behavior happen. And Peter says, let the passion of Christ be what drives you. But you see, these early Christians are a lot like some of us. Some of us that raised our hands and thought it was interesting there were no tens. Because he reminds them in a kind of a weird move in this passage. He says, don't go back and don't even think about doing what the Gentiles used to do. They're surprised that you don't live that way anymore. And I wondered why he put that in there. And then I had a conversation this week. I was sitting in my office with the clinical director of the Roxbury, where I work. We have just come through a licensing survey, and there's a whole bunch of things that we need to do to get our facility up to code. And we were sitting there talking about how all these plans and things that we got to do, trainings and changes and stuff. And I looked at her and I said, you know, you ever wish you could just go back and just take care of people and not worry about all this stuff? Be responsible for all this stuff? And she looked at me and she said, absolutely. Especially today. And it dawned on me as I was looking back over this passage that the reason that we like to reminisce, at least when it comes to going back there, is it keeps us from being responsible. You see, when I am at work and I have to look at all of these corrective things that I've got to do, I know it's up to me, not my employees, but me, to make sure this gets done. I become responsible. I sometimes have to stay later, to work a little harder, try to help them understand. And all of that falls on me to be responsible. There's a sense in which what Peter is saying here is that this temptation to reminisce, to want to slide back, to go back to what the Gentiles are doing, is that we kind of don't want to have to bear the responsibility. He's concerned that we're afraid to bear the responsibility of looking into the face of the crucified Jesus and saying, I've got a love like that. It's just easier to go back to the way it was. I often tell Becky when we're traveling after a sermon that the pastor's preached or something I've read, man, I wish I hadn't heard that. And she says, why? And I say, because now I got to do something about it. Now I'm responsible for it. The call for us is to be responsible. We have a responsibility to be ambassadors for redeeming God in a broken world. We are called to be liaisons for a kingdom that our mission is to recreate this world through the work of the Holy Spirit in our lives into what it's intended to be. Well, all the while we're harassed by the very creation that we're called to help. And sometimes that's a big responsibility. And it would be easier to just not care. It would be easier to just join the rest of the dissipation, the reckless abandon, the irresponsibility that comes. But instead, as followers of Christ, we are responsible to follow him. And then, when we do, we get called things like holier than thou's, do-gooders. We don't give in to temptation, and that we continue to be harassed. And Peter says that they are walking away from us. And we hear these words. Peter says they will have to give an accounting. And we go, yeah, they will. And for us, it's just that some kind of, we may have to suffer for Jesus now. We may have to go through all of this now, but one day they're going to get theirs. And some of you have a bewildered look on your face. But you know what I'm talking about. You've been to those places. You've heard those sermons. You don't get right with Jesus. You don't do what you're supposed to do. That's fine. Judgment day's coming, brother. Jesus is going to get you. He's going to get you good. But then Peter messes that up for us. If you haven't figured it out yet, these 11 verses I don't like very much. I should have preached from Paul. Peter clarifies his statement about a future accountability, and he says, as we're pondering the demise, he tells us that judgment will lead them to life in the Spirit of God. Read it in verse 6. It's right there in front of you. For this is the reason the gospel was proclaimed, even to the dead, so that though they have been judged in the flesh, as everyone is judged, they, not us, they might live in the Spirit as God does. What? Well, thank goodness pastors introduced us to N.T. Wright, because he helped me out here on this one. What Peter's talking about, what he's doing in this whole understanding of judgment, is judgment is not punishment. In fact, that's a misconception in our mind. God's not about punishing people. He has no interest in punishing us. In fact, what judgment is God making right all things that are currently out of order. That judgment that Peter's talking about is as we look in the face of the crucified Jesus, allow that passion to lead us into doing things into the world, and then we get harassed by those people that are out there who think there's something wrong with us, and they turn away from us, and they mock us, and they harass us, and they kind of stir up some holy ire within inside of us. Peter says their judgment is that God's trying to make a way for them too. He's trying to help them put things right. And all of a sudden, For me, as I was looking at this, I began to realize I believe what Peter's trying to say to the church. He's trying to say to us that when we are filled with the kind of love and passion that Christ has given, and we go out and live that out, that harassing that we get is not really irritating us as much as our lives are irritating them. And that we become for them a form of judgment without even trying. We become for them a recognition that things aren't right for those who aren't walking with Jesus, and they don't want to be responsible for that. But yet there we are. We create, we become, if you will, a means of grace for their lives. And they may reject that. And that's okay. So what about all of this? How do we maintain kind of this mission in the world until Jesus comes and sets up his kingdom? Well, the way we do it is we get together. Starting in verse 7 all the way through the end, what does Peter talk about? He doesn't say, take up arms, fight against them, none of that stuff. He just simply says, like a good football coach, he says, keep your eyes open. Keep your eyes open and your head in the game. And stay sharp. I mean, he says it a little bit different. He says, be serious and discipline yourselves. But it's the same thing. The coach, Peter the coach, says, keep your eyes open and your head in the game. Don't forget what this is all about, that we are to become a community of people who live this out, this love. We are kingdom ambassadors wherever we go. Peter encourages us to use our talents and our gifts, each of our skills, to support and maintain and care for each other. Our calling is to become a collection of people learning the way of Jesus as we live as an outpost of God's kingdom here on earth. And by doing this, we strive to become what our future promises. Evangelism for us is not to scare people into avoiding some kind of eternal damnation. Rather, it is demonstrating how what God is bringing in, and demonstrating now what God is bringing into our future. A world that is made right, and the will of God is the desire of everyone's heart. The desire to live in peaceful harmony, making beautiful things a place where love has destroyed all sin. The picture is, if I could paint this for you, is that in a world that harasses us for not fighting fire with fire, but for choosing to suffer in love as Christ did, the picture that Peter is painting for this church is this. The church is a community of love. And we stand not just as people going out and trying to grab people and drag them in, but our mere existence in the world creates an opportunity for them to have a taste of what's to come. Our responsibility is to behave in ways out of a passion that's driven by Christ that points people to our future hope that one day Christ will be here and he will reign on earth. And we, as his followers, we will participate with him. We begin to open those ideas up now. In preparing for this message, I read a sermon that was written by the 19th century philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. And he writes particularly on these words, "Love covers a multitude of sins." At the conclusion of the sermon, Kierkegaard begins to recall the story, John's story, of the woman caught in adultery. He says, her accusers bring her to Jesus, both to see her punished for her sin and to trick him. Jesus stoops down. He begins to doodle in the ground, in the sand, and accusers banter him with questions to try to get him to answer what they should do. But Jesus asks one simple question to the accusers. One simple question about their own sin. And one by one, the stones drop and the accusers fade away. It's now Jesus and the sinful woman. And at that moment, with just Jesus and this woman, love in the flesh bends down, stoops down, and her sins are gone, and her sinning is finished. Love covers a multitude of sins. So much of the time, I believe, as a church, we focus on what not to do. We miss the point. We are to love. And when we love as God's people, like Christ loved us, it covers a multitude of sins. And if you don't believe that, if you have a hard time struggling with you struggle with the idea that love can cover a multitude of somebody else's sins, I invite you to look in the face of the crucified Jesus and ask yourself, can love overcome a multitude of sins?